Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Democracy at Work, Learn, Discuss, Engage. And today's moderator will be Professor Stephen Johnston. Professor Stephen Johnston received his PhD from Johns Hopkins University. Professor Johnston is the Neil A. Maxwell Chair in Political Theory, Public Policy, and Public Service. He is the author of numerous articles and two books, including The Truth About Patriotism. Professor Johnston will soon publish his latest work, There Will Be Blood, The Tragedy of Democratic Politics, followed by the release of the companion volume, Tragedy and International Politics. Professor Johnston's teaching is concentrated in the areas of modern and contemporary political theory, globalization, and international politics, democratic theory, and politics and literature. Johnston also serves on the editorial board of the journal Theory and Event. Professor Johnston.
Apparently I'm quite busy. Before I start, I'd just like to thank a few people and organizations, starting with Pi Sigma Alpha, the National Political Science Honor Society, the Political Science Department's Student Advisory Committee, and the Political Theory Club. They're responsible for organizing this event today. I'd also like to thank the Hinckley Institute for providing us with this fine room. I'd also like to mention Samantha Brody, who's the Political Science Department's undergraduate advisor. She was also critical in putting this together. And I'd like to thank KUER for recording and posting this event on its website. And since I know none of us can get too much of electoral politics, I'll also mention that on November 30th, which is a Friday, there will be a post-election conference in the Carolyn Tanner Irish Humanities Building in the Jewel Box. And so there will be more information forthcoming about that event. So joining me today from your left to right are Professors James Curry, Samuel Hanlon, and Perry Schwartz-Shea. We will be turning to them in a moment. I just want to make a few introductory remarks to give you a sense for why this panel forum was entitled Democracy at Stake. So this is also a somewhat longer version of a piece that will be coming out on a blog called The Contemporary Condition, which I encourage you to take a look at. It's an interesting website with people writing about, as you can imagine, the contemporary condition. So Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan, and the Republican Party represent not just a disturbing, destructive social and political movement, they also pose a threat to the very ideas of democracy and democratic government. This can be seen, it's not as if they work hard or consistently to hide it, in two distinct, if also ultimately related ways. First, Republicans have been orchestrating a nationwide campaign to suppress voter turnout. Invoking the possibility of voter fraud, their own fabrication masquerading as a cause, the GOP has managed to pass numerous voter identification laws, especially in battleground states, to disenfranchise American citizens. The identification requirement, supposedly neutral, discriminates against the poor, elderly, young, and minorities, all of whom tend to vote Democratic. Republicans have also been purging election rosters of eligible voters, claiming, for example, citizens to be non-citizens, curtailing early voting periods, sanctioning voter registration campaigns with criminal penalties for the smallest of clerical errors, and whatever else they can think of to depress Democratic turnout. In moments of candor, they publicly admit these electoral measures are designed to produce one result, the election of Mitt Romney. Furious at the presidential election result 4 years ago, the GOP targeted for suppression groups critical to Obama's victory. The GOP also has at its disposal electoral vigilantes, True the Vote, who plan to harass and intimidate voters at the polls, effectively forcing or keeping them at home. The 2012 election could well produce an illegitimate president, a Republican who holds office by virtue of crimes against democracy. The GOP is utterly indifferent to such a possible outcome, believing that it and only it has a right to rule in the United States. This conviction, rooted in a sense of superiority, patriotism, and truth, informs another feature of Republican conduct dominant these last 4 years, a politics of total obstruction, even destruction, no matter the social or economic cost, of an African-American president they loathe. A minority party, the GOP acts as if it has a mandate to rule. Remarkably, Republicans believed from the start that there would be no political cost to their sabotage, insofar as they also believed the American voter would ultimately hold Obama responsible for the wreckage they produced. Republicans, in short, indulge an ugly form of political entitlement, namely that they can commandeer a system to produce their desired outcomes, which, by definition, are the right outcomes. The presumption of political entitlement matches their sense of social and economic entitlement, deploying the vast resources of the state, subsidies, tax breaks, etc., to enrich themselves, again, no matter the cost to others. This brings me to the second source of the threat the GOP poses to the very idea of democracy. To many observers of American politics, Republican machinations may seem excessive, but nothing more. Yet the GOP conducts itself domestically, much like European imperialism conducted itself in the heyday of Western colonization in Africa and the Middle East. The latter ignored the natives of the lands it conquered, unwilling and unable to see them or the ways of life they had cultivated for generations. Europeans would treat natives as effectively invisible and proceed to remake, read, steal, exploit, the country in their own grand image. The dominant motif of the Romney-Ryan campaign, similarly, is, we can rebuild it. This claim presumes and professes a sense of overwhelming power, a power capable of removing any obstacles in its path. The power is so fantastic that Romney believes his mere election will result in economic revival. He doesn't actually have to do anything to spur renewal. His mere status as president suffices. The claim also suggests that nothing meaningful or valuable, no institution, organization, party, program, or policy, stands in the way of rebuilding, certainly nothing Republicans can see. They are thus free to dismantle the social safety system and network of public institutions that tens of millions of hardworking citizens built across generations and earned through blood, sweat, and tears the right to enjoy. It would afford a modicum of protection against the regular, predictable ravages of an economic system the GOP would like to unleash on them. Accordingly, when Romney talks about getting government out of the way, this does not mean freeing economic actors to create jobs. They can do that already. It means leaving tens of millions of people exposed and vulnerable to the inevitable depredations of an economic and political system designed to concentrate wealth and power in fewer and fewer hands. Hence the pathological hatred of unions, whether public or private, and the drive to eradicate them from American life. Opposition, let alone resistance, cannot be tolerated. It's no coincidence that Romney and Ryan championed more of the same policies and programs that led to the greatest economic crisis and social destruction since the Depression. The super-rich thrive in these circumstances. The country may suffer, but they continue to prosper and further separate themselves from the rest. The GOP relishes the brutality of a class warfare in which it enjoys a virtual monopoly of the social, political, and economic weapons needed to wage it. The GOP disdains the so-called 47%. The real figure is actually much higher, which will be left to fend for itself in a world where it has been effectively disempowered, stripped of its prior social democratic accomplishments and protections in the name of free market utopianism. After all, the 47% are parasites. They produce nothing. They create nothing of value themselves. They only take from the government, which means they take that to which they have no real right. They can thus be ignored despite their real presence throughout the country. Worse, they can be acted upon, which is what the GOP plans to do as Republicans rebuild a country in no need of their imprint. The GOP dreams of a world in which the very rich arrogate to themselves the vast wealth a capitalist economy produces, an outcome made possible by rules, regulations, and practices they devise, given the force of law thanks to representatives they usher into office, courtesy of a political system they have bought, and sanctified by an activist Supreme Court they have installed. It's a vicious economic political noose that threatens to tighten the grip on democracy and make it yield to the slightest pressures from its masters. Republicans must rule the country they profit from, even pillage, while the rest of us are to be marginalized and dismissed, essentially foreigners in their own land. Those who think Romney and the GOP live in the 1950s may need to reset their calendars. They're not nearly so modern. Barack Obama, on the other hand, thinks of himself as au courant. This, too, should give the American democracy pause, especially when it comes to the exercise of presidential power. It could be argued that Obama has exceeded the constitutional iniquities of George Bush and Dick Cheney regarding the unitary executive. According to Obama, the President of the United States can try, convict, sentence, and execute its own citizens on his say-so. According to Obama, the President of the United States can deploy American military forces in a foreign civil war, as in Libya, where no national interest is at stake, ignoring the legal requirements of the War Powers Act, on his own say-so. According to Obama, the President of the United States can orchestrate a drone campaign as part of a global war on terror in an allied country, killing hundreds of innocent civilians, and be immune from prosecution for possible war crimes. According to Obama, it is more important to locate, prosecute, and imprison whistleblowers of illegal American conduct, such as torture, than it is to bring to justice those who commit crimes against human beings and the Constitution. According to Obama, while the United States now refuses to directly engage the practice of torture, it retains the right to employ extraordinary rendition and outsource it to regimes that have no such moral qualms. These are just some of Obama's assaults on the United States Constitution. On one thing, both parties are united. The executive branch can arrogate to itself whatever power it pleases, all in the name of the American democracy, of course. None of this, remarkably, is a subject of the current presidential campaign. In short, the two major parties, each making distinct, if different, contributions, pose threats to the present and future of democracy in this country that call for redress. Or so it seems to me. So those were some of the themes that spurred this forum to begin with. And so, having then had my say, I'd like to turn to my fellow panelists, starting with Professor Jim Curry.
Thank you. Given the theme of the panel today, I wanted to address my topic, or my comments, towards a topic that's something that I know a little bit about, which many people believe is a threat to democracy in our country today, and that is campaign spending and the rise specifically of outside groups and their campaign spending in this election cycle. As most of you probably know, in 2010, there were a couple Supreme Court rulings which changed our campaign finance system quite a bit. First was the highly publicized Citizens United ruling, which stated that through the Supreme Court's ruling that as far as the Constitution was concerned and as far as the First Amendment was concerned, there was no distinguishing between people and corporations or other entities. So essentially, any sort of independent spending on a campaign or an election would be seen as speech, and that this could not be restricted in any way via the Constitution. Now, the second ruling, which received far less attention, was the Speech Now versus FEC ruling, which is essentially the ruling that led to the rise of what we call today super PACs. The Speech Now ruling indicated that if a PAC was to spend just on independent expenditures, which, as the Supreme Court had already established, could be seen as free speech, they could receive and bring in donations of whatever size, unlimited size, from whomever, essentially allowing individuals to give unlimited amounts to PACs to spend on campaign ads, on other forms of campaign spending. The consequence of this for this election cycle, being the first election cycle in which we have this new system of campaign finance, has been a dramatic rise in spending, not only by super PACs, but by corporations, by labor unions, by various groups. To give you an idea of the numbers, as of Tuesday, the latest filings from the FEC, super PACs had raised over $500 million from donors and spent $428 million on independent expenditures. In addition to this, other outside groups, which include corporations, labor unions, other groups, have spent $272 million on the election. This is on top of a great deal of other sort of more traditional spending. The presidential candidates so far have spent $911 million on their election race. Candidates for the House of Representatives have spent $772 million. Candidates for the Senate, $476 million. And the political parties have spent $175 million. If you add all these numbers up, you find that so far, with 2 weeks to go of probably pretty heavy campaign spending, we have seen over $3 billion spent on this election, which is a staggering sum, far more than any past election. And just to give you an idea of the impact of the Supreme Court rulings, as far as independent expenditures are concerned, those types of expenditures done by super PACs, so far there have been $686 million total spent on independent expenditures. To compare this to past elections, in 2010, that total was $170 million. And in 2008, where we should expect more campaign spending because it was a presidential election, $123 million. So certainly these rulings have altered the landscape of campaign spending in our electoral system. Now, the important question here is, that's great. There's all this spending. That's probably bad. But does this kind of spending actually have an impact on our elections, on the outcomes, on our policy process? Regarding elections, contrary to popular wisdom, most political science research would tell you, no, it doesn't have much of an effect, especially not at the presidential level. Most research has found that campaign spending has only resulted in small shifts in election outcomes, so small shifts in vote totals, maybe a few percentage points, could be attributed directly to campaign spending. Now, you may say, well, in a close election, a shift of a few percentage points may be very significant. If the outcome is 51% to 49%, certainly campaign spending could have made a big difference. However, even given that, where this effect occurs and where it matters depends on very specified circumstances, namely that campaign spending only tends to matter significantly in an election when one side significantly outspends the other. So, for example, if we look at the presidential election this year, I have a hard time believing that campaign spending will shift the outcome. When you have the candidates spending nearly $1 billion, roughly split between the two, and you have outside groups spending hundreds of millions more, we've probably reached some saturation level in what campaign spending can actually do here and what campaign advertisements are likely to do over who votes for whom. However, this sort of campaign spending, this rise of outside groups, can have an effect at other levels, particularly at the congressional level, at their state and local level. More often in congressional campaigns and even more often in state and local campaigns, we find these large disparities between what one side spends versus the other. To give you an idea of where we might see an effect in 2012, the Center for Responsive Politics has estimated that 66% of the outside spending done in the 2012 election has been by conservative groups. If they have been strategic and targeted specific elections, potentially it could have an impact. However, I think what is important for us to understand is that campaign spending is not just about affecting who wins what election. It has far more deeper effects on our election system and our policy process. Regarding elections specifically, one thing that we know that campaign spending does and that campaigns in general do is they reinforce people's partisanship and they reinforce their policy predispositions. As a result, increased spending should see people harden their positions towards one party or the other, towards one candidate or the other, or towards specific policy issues. In this way, increased campaign spending that we've seen can result in increased polarization of the public. This could be one possible consequence. Another possible consequence is that we know that campaign spending and campaigns in general are about providing information to the public. So, on one hand, you could think that, well, all this additional spending is just providing more information, so people should be more informed, and this should be a good thing. However, something we know about campaign ads is that they are very, very short, typically 30 seconds, maybe a minute if you're lucky. The information that's provided in these campaign ads is typically a gross oversimplification of the issues. And so essentially, rather than providing more real information to the public, this type of campaign spending is providing more misinformation to the public, oversimplifying the issues, and leading to a public that sees issues as something that's things that are very simple, very clear-cut, black and white, rather than deep and very complex as the policy issues that we deal with actually are. So those are two potential impacts of spending, just on the election. However, I believe that the most damaging effect of this type of rise in spending occurs after the election. So we are unlikely, in my opinion, to see all this campaign spending really affect the balance of power in our government after November 6th and for the next 2 years. However, I think we are likely to see this type of spending have significant effects on what happens in our government, what public officials do over the next 2 years. So before I go into this, let me be clear. I do not think money buys the support of public officials. That's simply not how it works. Outside groups are far more sophisticated than that. They do not give money to opponents of their issues in the hopes of changing their mind. Public officials, elected officials, have far more concrete views than that. What groups do, what super PACs do, is they give money to and they support politicians, candidates, elected officials who already support their issues. They do this to bolster the amount of support that they have in Congress, in the executive branch, etc. Now, the consequence that I think we will see is that this type of spending will serve to tie public officials more strongly to these positions that they claim to already have. So, with more and more spending, we will find that public officials, members of Congress, those in the executive branch, the president, will be far more hesitant to compromise, to move away from their very strong issue positions during the next Congress. Because they want to keep the support of these groups that are willing to spend millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars supporting them and keeping them in office. They'd be somewhat unstrategic to very straight go against the opinions of people who have given them $30, $40 million to help their election campaign. So, to me, ultimately the consequence of this rise in spending, ultimately the consequence of these changes to our campaign finance system are that it should exacerbate polarization in our process, make compromise harder, and make gridlock worse. So it's clear that money in politics and this rise in spending on the 2012 campaign is probably a problem. But as we evaluate our campaign finance system, I don't think this should be the way that we look at it. We shouldn't look at it as, well, money has an influence and that's bad and we should change it. We should have certain standards by which we judge our campaign finance system and judge campaign spending in our country. And I believe the two primary factors we should think about are what level of disclosure is there in our campaign finance system and what level of accountability is there in our campaign finance system. So let me talk about this a little bit.
You're about 2 minutes.
2 minutes. This should be perfect.
Great.
Disclosure essentially is who is spending the money. Do we know who is spending the money? And we do. The Supreme Court was at least willing to uphold disclosure requirements. In a Speech Now ruling, the outside groups wanted also to get rid of disclosure requirements as long as they were just spending on independent expenditures. The Supreme Court said no, disclosure does not violate the First Amendment. So we know who gives the money as long as that person is giving more than $200 to any sort of political entity. So disclosure is okay. Accountability is more where we have a problem. And accountability is, are these donors accountable to the public, to the people? And they are not. There are certain people who have given tremendous amounts of money in this election. Sheldon and Miriam Adelson have given $36 million to groups in this election. Robert Perry has given $20 million. And the Simmons family has given $18 million. Now, we know little about these people. And if we do not like what they do in this election, if we do not like the money that they've given, if we do not like what the groups have done, unlike with candidates and unlike with political parties, the public has no way to hold these people accountable for the gross influence they have over our political system. Ultimately, I believe what the challenge will be for our elected politicians, hopefully, and should they take up this issue at some point in the future, is to try to devise a constitutional system that deals with this accountability issue. Because obviously the Supreme Court is not going to let us strictly restrict how much money people give in an election as long as that money is going towards independent campaign expenditures. But they need to try to develop a system in which we can hold people like the Adelsons accountable for the amount of influence they have over our system.
Thank you. Professor Hanlon?
Thanks. So thanks to everybody for inviting me. The many organizations that Stephen mentioned, I'm not going to try to repeat them all. So I come at this not from the perspective of somebody who studies American politics, but from the perspective of somebody who studies democracy around the world. And I think that whether we really think democracy is at stake in this election depends a lot on our definition of democracy. Definitions of democracy are fundamentally contested. The philosopher W.B. Galley famously called democracy an essentially contested concept, in that there is no correct definition. And there's a lot at stake in how we define democracy. There's a politics to that. But I come at the topic from the perspective of a fairly procedural definition of democracy, one that focuses on institutions like competitive, free and fair elections, civil liberties, and reasonably full suffrage, rather than more abstract concepts like popular sovereignty that are sometimes invoked by political theorists. And from this perspective, I'm going to take the somewhat contrarian position that, in my opinion, democracy is not really at stake in this election, and that no recent developments in American politics would come close to causing me to say, I don't think we should categorize America as having a democratic political regime anymore, or even if we think in terms of a scale of democracy that we should sort of knock America down a few notches on that scale. This is not to say that we don't have a lot of problems in our politics, but from this perspective at least, I think American democracy is actually quite robust and remains fairly unusual in that respect in global perspective. So what I want to do with my time is just discuss a couple of hot-button issues and put them in comparative perspective a little bit and sort of tell you why I don't think there are truly reasons to consider America any less of a democracy, the political regime here. And so the first issue relates to campaign financing. I'm going to kind of cut this short a bit just because Jim did such a nice job kind of summarizing the issues in a way much better than I could ever do. The point I would stress is that for scholars of democracy, the key issue here is really whether financing reduces competition. And when we look at the developing world, there are many, many political regimes that have multi-party elections but fall short of being full democracies. And largely because, you know, I guess among other reasons, campaign financing between incumbents and opposition is so unequal that the electoral playing field itself is incredibly tilted. And you know, this sort of speaks to what Jim was talking about in terms of levels of competition and local races. When, you know, we can see even more drastic examples when we kind of widen the comparative perspective. I mean, a very classic example close to home is in Mexican politics, where the PRI party won elections for 70 years during the 20th century. You know, they had elections, but they won for 70 straight years, largely because they typically outspent the opposition 100-1. And under those conditions, we can't really say that this is a full democracy, because it's sort of elections without competition, elections without uncertainty. You know who's going to win, and it's not close, and there's really no way for the opposition to compete. We can actually see many other examples if we look around the world. A lot of multi-party regimes in Africa, for instance, are a little bit like this. They sort of have a dominant party, and then the opposition doesn't have much chance. Putin's Russia, Chavez's Venezuela is very much like this right now. And the reason that these are threats are seen as threats to democracy by people who study regimes is because competitive elections is such a central aspect of how we think about democracy, that you have to have uncertainty in who's going to win. You have to have a reasonably fair playing field. And I think that there are many reasons, as Jim talked about, to think that our campaign financing laws are really bad and lead to pathologies in our political system. But sort of the lack of robust and fair competition is not one of them, for precisely the reasons Jim talked about, that it is in, you know, both parties in our two-party system are quite good at raising money and spending it. And
clearly.
So the second issue that I wanted to talk about relates to voter ID laws and disenfranchisement, which Stephen raised. So as Stephen pointed out, in this last cycle, many state legislatures, almost all controlled by Republicans, have passed these stricter laws to requiring voters to show various forms of identification, often picture identification, official picture identification, in order to vote. And it kind of turns out that the types of acceptable ID differ from state to state. For instance, one of the issues is whether student IDs are allowed, which is something that certainly you guys can identify with. So picture ID requirements in and of themselves are not really a problem. You know, in fact, most European countries have the requirement that you show picture ID to vote, oftentimes actually even more stringent than any of these laws proposed in America. A lot of Latin American countries also require that picture ID is shown to vote. The issue is that because we don't have a compulsory system of national identification, kind of issuing national ID cards to all of our citizens, lots of people don't have picture ID, and thus will have trouble voting under these new laws. And in sort of a place like Austria or the Netherlands, you don't have the same issue because everybody basically has a picture ID. They're, you know, it's something that you get very early in life, this sort of national ID card. And you know, people may lose it, but sort of if you look at statistics about the percentage of people who lack these IDs, it's very low. So I'm personally completely opposed to these laws, at least in the absence of a national ID card. And I think they're bad policy and unethical. But I also think that they're not meaningful threats to democracy. So how do I sort of square that circle? Let's back up for a second. One fundamental criteria for democracy, for people studying political regimes from this procedural institutional perspective, is a high degree of inclusiveness. And by this I mean sort of reasonably full suffrage among adult citizens is generally seen as an important criteria dimension of democracy. You know, even if you have free and fair elections, protections for civil liberties, et cetera, if the right to vote, sort of the effective ability to vote, is not given to a large group within the population, that's generally considered reason not to consider a country a democracy. So one type of restriction is just to sort of take the franchise away from groups within society based on social characteristics. You know, these practices have been prevalent historically. Most countries didn't grant women the right to vote for a long time. Some countries didn't allow certain racial or ethnic minorities the right to vote, or they restricted the right to vote, the franchise, based on things like property holding requirements. And this leads to a lot of interesting debates about what should or should not be considered a democracy, especially when we think back historically. And you know, things can get very contentious when you start arguing, for instance, that the United States wasn't really a democracy until the 1960s, because some people don't want to, you know, they are sort of opposed to that notion. But another type of restriction on the effective exercise of the franchise is to design voting and electoral rules in such a way as to make it really hard or costly to vote. So you're saying, okay, everybody can vote, but we're going to design the system to make it really hard for people to vote. And so these practices have also been historically really common. You know, for instance, in 19th century Latin America, you had electoral regimes across most of the region, but hardly any democracies. Because not only was the franchise restricted based on social characteristics, but a lot of these techniques were used to further winnow down the electorate. You know, if we look at, just to show you sort of one example, in Buenos Aires in 1880s, the city contained about a little over 400,000 people. The number of actual valid votes in the presidential election of that year was 6,000. So, and that's not because nobody was sort of given the franchise, but because certain ways were employed to make sure that people didn't vote. Now, the example, the sort of obvious example closer to home, is provided by institutions like poll taxes levied in the southern states during the Jim Crow era that made it costly and logistically difficult to vote, and which were sort of overtly intended to suppress turnout, especially among African Americans. Political scientists have estimated that poll taxes reduced turnout by about 25% in the states and reduced African American turnout by about 50%. So huge decreases in turnout. So what about voter ID laws? How do they compare? I think the very simplistic perspective on this that unfortunately, it gets picked up a lot in the media, is sort of really just focuses on the percentage of people without picture ID. And sort of, you know, there's some surveys that the Brennan Center is one group that sort of has publicized this a lot that suggests, for example, that 11% of Americans don't have picture ID. And the proportions among young people and minority groups are even higher than that if you look at subgroups, like Stephen mentioned. So these seem like big
numbers.
2 minutes? Okay. So these seem like really big numbers. And what I'm going to also argue is that those big numbers are actually generated by asking the wrong question. And the real question is how much turnout is likely to go down because of voter ID laws. There are actually quite a number of studies in political science estimating these effects. And these studies suggest a very different picture. We find some disagreement whether turnout will go down at all. And when we find effects, they're generally quite small. So one recent meta-analysis suggested maybe a decrease in turnout of about 2%. So why is that number so much smaller? And the key issue here is really that it's not the number of people who don't have picture ID, but rather the proportion of registered and likely voters who don't have picture ID. And what we find is that if you look at the group that doesn't have picture ID, most of those people are not registered to vote to begin with or not likely to vote. If we just kind of think about the turnout effect, it's really much smaller. So what does 2% mean? On the one hand, it means millions and millions of people in our country will not be able to vote. And I have a huge problem with that. I think it is wrong and unethical. And that's why I'm very staunchly opposed to these laws. On the other hand, 2% is a fairly small number when we think in comparison of sort of if our perspective is sort of restrictions on the franchise or the effective use of the franchise. I mean, the difference between reducing turnout through a poll tax by 25% and reducing turnout by 2% through a voter ID law, to me, is substantively huge. And generally, effects like 2% on turnout aren't large enough that most sort of people who study political regimes would say, okay, that's not a democracy because they have a law that reduced turnout by 2%. In fact, if we're kind of looking at that world, there are actually quite a number of different sort of electoral laws or decisions that can have that level of effect on turnout, like whether you can vote by mail or even the type of voting machines that people use. That doesn't change turnout, but it changes the proportion of valid votes. And so I guess what I would argue is that it's useful to have a perspective where we support types of laws that will enhance the franchise as much as possible, and we condemn laws that are overtly used to decrease, to sort of disenfranchise people. But at the same time, we don't necessarily decide that something like a voter ID law is going to fundamentally change our notion of whether this is a democratic political regime or not. We have to be able to distinguish between things like poll taxes reducing by 25% and things like voter ID laws reducing by 2%. And it frustrates me a little bit that, just as my last comment, as an opponent of these laws, that oftentimes those things get conflated by other opponents of the law. That, Eric Holder gets out and calls this, equates it to the poll tax. And I think that's actually a very deceptive thing to do. And it doesn't make the voter ID law any less abhorrent from my perspective. But to me, the sort of opposition to these laws has also sort of engaged in some sort of fuzzy argumentation. And that bothers me a little bit. Anyway, I'll just wrap up right there.
Thank you. Professor Schwartz-Shea.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for, yes, I'll do as Sam did. Thanks to all the organizations that Stephen named. I'm going to start with talking about the gender gap and then kind of end with the comments about whether democracy is at stake. So at least in my lifetime, this is the most attention I've ever seen to the gender gap. So I want to talk a little bit about how it gets defined and why it matters, and then how might we understand that gap. People may not know that the gender gap was actually a term that the National Organization of Women coined as a political tactic. And when you talk about the gender gap, usually it's referencing voting, but it can also refer to other kinds of political activities and to attitudes as well. The main gap that people are pointing to in this election and in past elections as well is that women as a group are tending to vote for the Democratic Party and men as a group are tending to vote for the Republican Party. Now, when you put it that way, it sounds kind of like a puzzle, right? If the Republicans have a woman problem, don't the Democrats have a man problem, right? This looks symmetric. The reason it matters is that women in the country outnumber men, they register more than men, and they vote more than men. So the Census Bureau estimated that in 2008, 10 million more women than men voted. So that's why the gap matters substantively. Now, how can we understand that gap? Political scientists and pollsters have used survey techniques to try and get a handle on why there might be this gap between men's and women's and on what at and what issues. I mean, one thing to mention right from the start is that it is a gap, maybe 10%, 12% at the outset, 7%. So it's a gap, not a chasm. And there are other social divisions that are much more important that we don't pay attention to. And part of that is this strategizing and the outnumbering of women in the country, outnumbering men. Okay, so it's a gap, not a chasm. But how can we understand that gap? You can find practically any poll, if you're just looking at polls in kind of a random way, that are going to show you gaps of various sizes. So you really do have to be careful and look at a number of polls and to look at particular issue areas. We know that any particular poll the answers are going to vary depending on the sampling error, depending on how the questions are worded, etc. So that's why it's really important to look at a whole number of polls in particular issue areas. So the four issue areas that scholars have looked at are attitudes towards so-called women's issues, and this includes not only reproductive rights, but attitudes towards women's role in society. So back in 1972, they asked the first question about the role of women in society, and they phrased it in this way with that classic Likert scale. Recently, there has been a lot of talk about women's rights. So this is 1972. Some people feel that women should have an equal role with men in running, business, industry, and government. Others feel that women's place is in the home. Where would you place yourself on the scale? So 7 is equal role, 1 is in the home. So they've been asking that question since 1972. So there's the women's issues, reproductive rights and role in society. That's one issue area. A second issue area is kind of social policy, like prayer in school and whether you favor sex education in high school, that kind of thing. A third area is use of force, and this is things like boots on the ground, guns, and also death penalty. And then the final area is the role of government and support for the safety net. So when you think about those four areas, most people are going to point towards reproductive rights and women's role as the big area that's going to divide people. But if you look at enough polls across the four issue areas, what you find is there's not a lot of disagreement at the mass level, we're not talking activists or political parties, at the mass level between men and women when it comes to women's role in society and reproductive rights. What has happened is that men and women together have become more liberal with a small L. So if you look at abortion attitudes, right, they were much more restrictive in the 1970s in the masses of people, and now they are more liberal. When it comes to women's issues such as equal role with men in running business, industry, and government, when the question was first asked in 77, about 50% of the country were saying equal role. By 1994, that had increased to about 70%, and in 2000 to about 80%. So men and women are agreeing, essentially, on reproductive rights and on women's roles in running the country. Now, so where do you get the difference? Where do you get the gap? The gap is on the role in government. And so women as a group tend to agree that we need the safety net in a way that men don't. And to the extent that the Democratic Party has positioned itself in that way, women are leaning toward the Democratic Party. But why? Why do women differ in this way, not as a chasm, but as a gap from men? And what scholars do is they look essentially at the structure of the society and how women as a group differ from men as a group. And what they find is not very surprising. We know that women as a group earn less than men as a group. We know that women as a group are more likely to hover right above the poverty line than men as a group and fall into poverty. What that means is that women are taking advantage of some of those government programs, right? They're using Head Start. If they're single mothers, they might be on TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. Their children might be getting free lunch through school. They might be in subsidized housing. And, of course, since women live longer than men, they're depending on Social Security longer. So you have kind of structural reasons to understand why women as a group are much more likely to support the stance that the Democratic Party is now taking. What's interesting is that people forget that things have actually changed. So in the 1950s, it was the Republican Party that had a plank that supported the Equal Rights Amendment and not the Democratic Party. That changed when the Equal Rights Amendment was went out of Congress and into the states, and then you had a lot of debate, and at that point you had basically a polarization of activists. So you had feminists going to the Democratic Party and trying to influence it, and anti-feminists like Phyllis Schlafly of the National Eagle Forum going to the Republican Party and trying to influence it. So that's where you got that switch and that polarization of the parties on women's issues, even though at the mass level, again, there's a lot of similarity between men and women. The other thing that I would encourage people to do if they're interested in gender issues is to go to a website called CAWP, the Center for American Women and Politics. And that's where you're going to find kind of more reliable statistics, maybe not as up-to-date, but more reliable. So Sam actually sent me a New York Times piece about the gender gap. And I looked at the numbers, and I said, where is this guy getting these numbers? They were huge. I was like, I don't know where he's getting them. And again, so you have to look very carefully at the sources. Even though it was New York Times, I was really, really surprised. Now, in terms of the theme of the panel is democracy at stake, I want to return to a study that was done in 1991 by a scholar named Virginia Sapiro. And she looked at the women's movement as an agent of socialization and trying to produce change. And her comment was that we needed to convince women at least that the country right now doesn't even qualify as a democracy when 50% of the population only has 16% of their members in the governing bodies. So that gap between 16% of members of Congress as women and 50% of the population, is this a democracy, right? Now, that's a more substantive kind of rather than process definition of democracy, but very important. The other last thing that I would point you to, and I just just found this website the other day. It's fascinating if you're interested in media coverage. It's called fourthestate.net. And essentially, it has all sorts of graphics that are analyzing media coverage. So I did check it out to see it. It looks legit. So it has this just incredible graphic about coverage of the gender gap, or the gender gap in media coverage in the 2012 election, asking who gets heard who gets asked to comment on issues. So in this particular graphic, they were looking at the percentage or proportion of women quoted by major newspapers, the percentage of women or proportion quoted by major media companies, and quoted by top TV news shows. So for major newspapers like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, 65 to 75% men quoted about electoral issues. For media companies, Time Warner, NPR, News Corporation, again, 67 to 75% men quoted. Women quoted by top TV news shows, 87% men, right? So we're getting close back to the 16% that is in Congress, right? Probably most shocking to me was percentage of women quoted for discussions of abortion, 12%, birth control, 20%, Planned Parenthood, 26%, women's rights finally got to 50%. Okay, so the issue of how to think about democracy is complex. We've got our procedural definitions, we've got the percentage of people who are representatives, and then we have the media and the voice, right? Are women's voices being heard in proportion to their 50% of the population? And the answer is no. Okay. So I'll end there.
Thank you very much. So we're going to take some questions now. Joseph will be passing around the microphone to whoever would like to start our discussion.
Yeah, if you have a question, please just speak clearly into the microphone. I had a question, actually, if I could start with it. I know you didn't really specifically touch on this, but is the Electoral College something that you all would consider as potentially a threat to democracy? And if you could just each take a really quick second to answer that, because I know that's something a lot of people care about.
I would abolish it. I think it's structurally anti-democratic. It violates the rule of one person, one vote. And I know once upon a time it was designed to try to protect smaller states, but I don't think those protections are necessary. So it leads to certain anomalies. So, for example, if you're inclined to vote for Barack Obama in this state, you're effectively disenfranchised at the presidential level, and I think that's problematic. And you could flip that around as well for other states. So I think it can't be justified. There are structural impediments to eliminating it, which I realize. I don't think it's going anywhere, but I would abolish it.
I would agree. I would be in favor of abolishing the Electoral College. I don't think it's necessary in any way. I do think the largest impediment to abolishing it is that elections in this country are run by the states, and if you did get rid of the Electoral College and you just had a national vote, to some degree you would have to increase the federal bureaucracy to take care of these elections, which people are probably not going to like.
I would also abolish it. I don't know. I don't necessarily consider it undemocratic but I think it does skew representation quite a bit. And you know, I would also just note that actually quite a number of electoral rules that also skew representation. I mean, the fact that California has two senators and Wyoming also has two senators is also, you know, in some ways a similar thing.
We can move on to the Senate next.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add. I don't see a lot of positives from the Electoral College. Yeah, but it's going to take a lot of political capital to make the change, and is that where we want to invest our political capital? That's part of the question.
Okay, my name is Lina Svedin. I'm with the Political Science Department. I was going to pick up on something that Professor Hanlon was talking about, and that is competitiveness in the political system. You know, I have a European background and proportional representation, and to what extent would y'all, consider the American political system competitive in terms of the ability to start and initiate some sort of third party, fourth party, and actually get a diversity of representation in terms of political views.
Well, I started first last time. Perry, why don't we start with you, and then we'll go this way.
Well, I mean, this is Sam's territory, so tell me if I misspeak, but, you know, I mean, we don't have an electoral system that is designed for multi-parties. It's designed to produce two parties. So you really have to change the winner-take-all system that we have. And, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of parliamentary systems versus the two-party system, you get coalitions at different levels, right? Do you want your coalitions at the party level, or do you want your coalitions at the government level? So I guess I'm a little bit agnostic on that question. Restate it one more time, because I think I had another comment. It was, remind me.
I just said, what do you think is the competitiveness in terms of the political system?
Yeah, I mean, I'm feeling more like it's a competition, an oligarchic competition, right? Let's go from one party to another, and the differences between those parties in terms of their ties to money seem pretty similar, right? But that said, you know, there's something to be said for peaceful transfer of power between oligarchs, right? At least the rest of us, we're not fighting in the streets. You know, so if you take that kind of long-term historical perspective about peaceful transfer of power between the powerful, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I would add is, you know, I would imagine the prospects for third parties are not good precisely because of the electoral system that we have that really favors two-party competition with single-member districts with first-past-the-post winners. You do, actually, if you look around the world, you can find examples of countries that have that system and do have more than two parties, but oftentimes they're countries where politics in important ways are very regionalized. So to some degree, Britain is an example of this, but sort of more spectacularly, a country like India. But that's just because you have very important kind of regional and social cleavages that end up sort of causing different parties to form in different parts of the country. And this sort of, you know, given that what we have now, I used to live in San Francisco. There, this is probably sort of like the biggest example in some ways because the mayoral elections are generally contested between the Democrats and the Greens, and still the Greens can't win. So, you know, I mean, if a third party was to start, I would think it would start, like, in a very favorable region like that. But, you know, if the Greens can't win in San Francisco, then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree. I don't think our system can ever really allow for a viable third or fourth or any sort of minor party. I'm not certain that, I mean, as far as that does exclude voices in our political system, that is true. I'm not sure it really affects competitiveness. I think if you switch between our system and a proportional representation system, you would find problems with competitiveness vary, different types of competitiveness problems, but certainly it does shut out certain voices in our political system.
Well, in addition to what my three colleagues have mentioned, I think it's also important to keep in mind the way in which money can influence this. And so, as Sam mentioned, that and Jim too, that the money that goes to local elections can affect competitiveness. Yes. So following the 2010, at least from the Democratic point of view, electoral disaster, you had Republican legislatures rewriting congressional districts in order to more or less guarantee that the elections would be as uncompetitive as possible. In fact, you have in Texas a plan that was designed by Republicans to try to blunt the 4% rise in the Hispanic population. That legislative effort was actually halted by either the Justice Department or a federal court. I don't remember which. So you can see that the lack of competitiveness comes from a number of different directions. And we'd also have to be thinking about things like incumbency and how often incumbents are returned and that sort of thing. But I don't see a great deal of competitiveness, especially at the congressional level or even in the Senate level. Well, this actually concludes the formal part of our program, the part that is being recorded by KUER. So I would like to thank my colleagues, Jim Curry, Sam Hanlon, and Perry Schwartz-Shea for their insights into today's forum and into the 2012 presidential election campaign. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming as well. And we look forward to our next forum.